I'm Mark Carroll, and welcome to episode 128 of Carroll Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. Toot toot! Beep beep! This week we're going to revisit a high point of the disco era with a bit of late 60s psychedelic pop thrown in. Bruce Sedano was married to arguably the greatest disco artist there was, Donna Summer. Not only that, but he co-wrote and played on one of her biggest hits, Bad Girls, as well as other songs. And if you look at the cover of Summer's classic 1979 album, Bad Girls, that's Sedano dressed as a cop. Listen! 10 years earlier, Tommy James and the Shondells had a dreamy single, Ball of Fire, that hit the top 20 and led that year's The Best of Tommy James and the Shondells collection. A young Bruce Sedano co-wrote that song too, after the singer of Money Money, Crimson and Clover, and Crystal Blue Persuasion took him under his wing. How did that happen? Tommy James went on to co-write a 1970 top 10 hit, Tighter Tighter, for Sedano's band, Alive and Kickin'. Sedano and that band opened for Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention, Chicago, and Eric Burdon and War. Sedano then spent a few years as a solo singer-songwriter before playing keyboards in the R&B disco band Brooklyn Dreams, which had a minor 1978 hit, Music, Harmony, and Rhythm. In early 1979, Brooklyn Dreams collaborated with label mate Donna Summer on two versions of the song Heaven Knows. Summer's version hit number 4, and Summer and Sedano clicked professionally and personally. Bad Girls followed. How did that song come together? What was it like for the two of them as the Bad Girls album and Summer's career soared, even as Brooklyn Dreams kept touring? Sedano and Summer, who got married in 1980, worked together on more of her songs and co-wrote the ballad Starting Over Again, based on Sedano's parents.
Mama moved out, Daddy sold the house, they split up the money.
That song became a 1980 smash, not for Summer, but Dolly Parton, making Summer the first black female to co-write a number one country song.
All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put mommy and daddy back together again. Starting over again.
How did Summer handle the fast pace and artistic changes of her album releases? How did Summer's and Sedano's lives together evolve, including a time when he managed her? Sedano also talks about co-writing the 1984 Jermaine Jackson song, Tell Me I'm Not Dreamin', Too Good to Be True, a duet with Brother Michael that later was covered by Robert Palmer. Donna Summer died of lung cancer in 2012 at the age of 63. Since then, Sedano has recharged his own career, recording 4 albums and 3 EPs. His just-released album, Talkin' Ugly Truth, Tellin' Pretty Lies, features a duet with Valerie Simpson on Two Bleeding Hearts.
Two bleeding hearts and a wounded love. Two bleeding hearts and a wounded love.
The percolating title track has racked up almost 2 million views on YouTube since it debuted a month ago.
Talkin' Ugly Truth.
How's he become so prolific in his 60s and 70s? How has his songwriting evolved over the years? He now splits his time between Milan, Italy, where he wrote the new album, and Los Angeles, where he and his daughters recently accepted a Lifetime Achievement Grammy Award for Donna Summer. How did that happen this year? Sedano, representing Summer's estate, also has sued Kanye West and Ty Dolla $ign in federal court for copyright infringement for their use of Summer's I Feel Love in their song Good Don't Die. We do not discuss this pending litigation in our conversation, but he covers plenty of other hot stuff. Please enjoy this Carroll Pop conversation with Bruce Sedano. How was your Grammys weekend?
Pretty cool. Donna received a Lifetime Achievement Award, and so I went with my daughters, and they did this presentation wasn't part of the Grammy thing, but it was at a theater in Hollywood. you know, Laurie Anderson also won an award, Gladys Knight. So there was a bunch of good people there, Peter Asher. And, you know, I went up and accepted for Donna and said a few words, and it was great. You know, and then the following day I went to the actual Grammys, and it was pouring rain here, and, you know, everybody was kind of freaked out. And but the show was not bad, considering shows like that. And certainly the highlights for me were, you know, Tracy Chapman and Joni Mitchell. And I didn't get to see Billy close the show. Bill Joel, I kind of left right before that because I'm old and I didn't want to hassle with everybody in the middle of everybody leaving.
I totally get that. Billy Joel song's okay. I feel like there's a little bit too much branding exercise in that song. Like, I would have rather hear him sing about more people in his, you know, neighborhood or stuff than just this, like, did I come back too late or did I wait too long? I don't know. It's okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's a love song more or less about, you know, a relationship and maybe not taking it for granted, but somewhere in there. And you know, my feeling about it was, you know, it's like the sound is like an old friend.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, you know, meeting an old friend on the street and be like, oh, it feels so good to see you, you know? So that was more than analyzing the song or whatever. The feeling that I had was that it's really nice to hear Billy.
Yeah. I sound like a total ingrate even complaining about the song. I mean, it's a real song that he wrote. He hadn't put out anything in 30 years. It's not something they cobbled together out of an old cassette from, you know, 40 years ago or something like that.
The interesting thing that was that he almost never co-wrote, and this is a co-write.
Right. I think there are three other writers on it.
Yeah, exactly. So, but anyway, you know.
So how is this the year that they gave Donna a Lifetime Achievement Award?
Who knows? You know, I'm somebody who I'm an artist. So I live in that world. You know, a third of what I do is overseeing Donna, you know, and so it's not, and I have great people in place who are really helpful and, you know, but things like that, they happen when they happen, you know, while I was at the Grammy party, I met, somebody from ASCAP who's on the board of the Songwriters Hall of Fame. And I got introduced to him and I said, hi, nice to meet you. And then I went, love to love you, baby. I feel love. She works hard for the money on the radio. Bad girls. Shouldn't Donna be in the Songwriters Hall of Fame? And he was like, she's not.
I'm right.
Like, no. So we'll see what happens. See what happens next year with that. You know, so we worked hard the last couple of years on the documentary, and the documentary has done extremely well and been very well received. And
directed by your daughter, Brooklyn.
Co-directed by my daughter, Brooklyn, along with Roger Ross Williams. You know, before that, we did the musical. And, you know, so it's always part of, you know, everything that I do.
I'm in this Vinyl Me Please record club, and a few years ago they put out this, you know, all analog, newly remastered version of Bad Girls. And I'd never owned Bad Girls. It just was like ubiquitous from when I grew up. I was like totally the right age to have heard that, you know, and all the songs from it like a million times. But I never actually owned it, and I picked it up and I'm like, well, obviously this is like a really great record, you know, and you sort of take it out of the context. You're just like, this thing just jumps out of the speakers and sounds fantastic.
Yeah, no, it's a great record. It's a great sounding record. And it's it. And I'm the cop on the cover. Do you know that?
No, I did not know that.
That's me.
That's funny. So, and I have to say also, Ball of Fire was always one of my favorite Tommy James and the Shondells songs. I think the first album of theirs I bought, it probably was used, but it was a copy of, you know, the Tommy James and Shondells greatest hits. And it's the first song on there. And I'm like, oh, what is this cool, dreamy, psychedelic song?
Yeah.
And that's him and you. And,
there's a bunch of us on there, but it was basically me, him, and Woody Wilson. How that happened was, you know, I had my band at the time, Alive and Kicking, and we were the house band at this like super hot club in Manhattan at the time. And it was the late 60s. It was probably 1968, I'm pretty sure. And the club was called The Cheetah. It was on 52nd Street, right off 8th Avenue in Manhattan. And we were basically the house band. We played six nights a week, you know, four or five sets a night. One night Tommy came in and here I'm still in my teens as Tommy James. He's basically, you know, right at the peak of his career, just in peak moment. And here he is. And I'm an aspiring songwriter and a musician. And, turns out he lived right around the corner from the club. And so on breaks, I would go to his apartment and try to write songs with him. And Ball of Fire was one of the things. And my manager doesn't like me saying this, but whenever I tell the story, I always say, yes, my contribution to that song was the word of. it was a great experience, you know. And then, you know, and then Tommy produced my band Alive and Kicking, and we had a big hit the next year. And
Tighter.
Yeah. And, you know, I got to be around while he was making Crimson and Clover and Crystal Blue Persuasion and to be in the studio. That was the first time I was ever in a real recording studio, you know? So, in those days, everybody didn't have a recorder in their bedroom, you know, like it is today. And to record back in those days was, you know, it was a treat. It was an honor. It was, so anyway. That's Tommy.
He goes to see Alive and Kicking. He's just going to see your band. How do you get from that to you guys are writing songs together? I mean, what clicked between the two of you where he was like, yeah, I'm going to work with this kid?
You know, I don't know. The only two things I can answer that question is he's a very kind and generous guy. And I was a very eager and ambitious, you know, young kid.
So did you go up to him and say, hey, you know, I'd love to write songs with you?
I don't think so. My band's manager somehow knew the girl that he was dating at the time or was with at the time. So there was some kind of advanced hookup, which enticed him to come to the club and see us. And so maybe through that afterwards. But it was basically Tommy is just generous. So yeah, he was a very big mentor in my life.
And you were playing keyboards in Alive and Kicking, right?
I was playing. Yeah, I was.
And writing. What were your sort of aspirations as an artist and for the band at that point? Were you thinking, oh, we want to be like this sort of rock band or pop band? I mean, I think that you'd done some musical theater. Were you thinking along those lines too? Like, what was the goal at the point that Tommy James came into your life?
Well, for Alive and Kicking, we wanted to make records, you know, I was always writing songs. When we weren't playing, we were rehearsing. I put the band together with Pepe, who was one of the lead singers, and then we added Sandy Toter as the female singer, and Johnny Paricio, who was the best lead guitarist in the neighborhood, you know, and Woody Wilson, who was a multi-instrumentalist, but was a really good songwriter and could sing really high. We worked a lot. I mean, we worked the same circuit that at that point, Billy Joel was in a band called The Hassles.
Right.
There was another band. One of my favorite bands of the time was called The Vagrants. And Leslie West was the guitar player in The Vagrants and The Young Rascals, you know. So we were, all in that circuit, basically playing the same clubs in Long Island, New York, and Jersey.
What was your sort of light bulb moment where you thought, I need to do rock and roll music?
You know, when I was a kid, first of all, my father was an amazing singer. He always had the radio on and, you know, he was more, you know, obviously a singer, but his generation was more into the Sinatra, Vic Damone, you know, kind of style, but he was very musical. My uncles were musical. They would come over to the house and sit around my kitchen table and two of them would play guitars. One would play an accordion and my father would sing. So this was happening all the time. When I was about nine, I got taken to the Brooklyn Fox Theater and I saw an Alan Freed rock and roll show. And then on top of this, my father had a jukebox route. And so he was always bringing 45s into the house, and there was always boxes of, you know, and I became intrigued with the names under the song titles, which was the songwriters. And I guess, you know, always my inclination was, you know, was to be a songwriter. You know, I think that's how I saw myself integrating myself into the business. This is where I felt I had the ability to compete and the desire to compete, you know. So, you know, I was fortunate enough to have an Italian grandfather bring me an accordion back from Italy when I was 4 years old. And, you know, so I took accordion lessons for 4 years. It gave me a basic foundation of music and chord structure and, you know, and all of this. Accordion's an interesting instrument because on the right hand, you're playing treble clef, and on the left hand, you're playing bass clef. So it was an interesting, you know, it was a full scope of, you know. And then in school, I was just into poetry. You know, I just love poetry and I love poets. And you know, I would, you know, write poetry through science class. And so, and once I hit my teens, I put a band together, you know, and you know, there were a few bands before Alive and Kicking.
Do you remember the first song you wrote?
I don't, you know. Yeah. And my friend Pepe Cardona, the lead singer of Alive and Kicking, who passed away 2 years ago, was the person who, he would call me and sing songs back to me, leave them on voice messages of songs that I wrote when I was 14 years old that I have no memory of. And
That's funny.
You know, so he was the keeper of all the, you know, the scrapbook of all the photos and all the clippings and the Record World when we were on the cover of Record World magazine. And, you know, when we played Madison Square Garden and the time we opened for Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention, Pepe had all that filed, you know. So, but me, no, I'm always worried about today and tomorrow.
Do you remember when you started writing, were you writing lyrics first or was it all kind of coming together or music or what?
I always had, I think my strength as a songwriter is on the lyrical side of things. So I've always leaned into that. And even in collaboration, a lot of times I would collaborate with people and I would be the lyric writer. You know, I did a number of things with Michael Omardian back in the 80s. And basically he would compose music and I would write lyrics.
In what order did you do them? Would you write the lyrics to his music or do you write the music to your lyrics?
I would write lyrics to his music.
So something like Tell Me I'm Not Dreaming, which you did for Jermaine Jackson that he sang with Michael Jackson. That's one you co-wrote with him. Is that, are those your words then?
Yes. Yeah. You know, and there's, you know, I think there's four songs that we co-wrote on that particular album, you know, you know, now, you know, since Donna passed away, it's when I really began this phase of my career. And this new record that I'm putting out March 1st, Talking Ugly Truth, Telling Pretty Lies, is the sixth, I believe, album that I've done since 2013, since Donna passed away. And since that time, all these songs that I've written have been solo songs. I've written them by myself. I basically haven't co-written in a long time. And that's not to say that I won't ever do it again, because I like to collaborate. But at this phase of my life, it's really, you know, I want to say the things that I want to say the way I want to say them. I've been so inspired over this phase, beginning with the death of Donna, I've been pretty prolific. And I never know, you know, it's like this record is coming out now. And I'm like, oh, well, we never know if there's going to be another song, you know. I mean, I assume there will be. But you know, I don't know when that flow starts, but I've been in a pretty steadfast flow for the last 10 years.
Are you writing similarly to how you used to? Or are you still sort of going with the lyrics first and then working on the music, or how's that working?
No, these days I basically start at, mostly on guitar, sometimes at the piano. I basically don't start with any idea. I just sit with the instrument and I vibe and I stream of conscious until I stumble on something that sparks me. And then I go like, okay, I have this. And once I have that initial spark of inspiration and the direction of what I'm singing about, then becomes the craft of songwriting. That's when I'll say, okay, this is what I have. I basically have a sense of how the structure would be. How do I say this? How do I say this in an inventive way, in a non-cliche way, in an inspired way, and in a way that suits me? The one thing that I wanted this phase to be is where every song that I write, I can sing sit at my guitar and play it, and it's complete just in that form. When I was back in the 80s and I was co-writing and doing all these things, a lot of times I was writing to tracks, a lot of times I was creating tracks to write lyrics to and things like that. And it's a completely different way of attacking it. And for me, the best way is this particular way of doing it. It's kind of how I came up with the Starting Over Again, the song that Dolly Parton cut.
Right.
That's really my wheelhouse of a real life story, an emotional story, a physical feeling, a philosophical idea. These are the kind of things that I pull from.
That one sprung from the divorce of your parents, from what I understand.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. The story around that song, it's Donna and I are, this is before we're married, but we're living together, and I'm in one of the back bedrooms on a Fender Rhodes, and I'm writing Starting Over Again, and she opens the door, sticks her head in, and goes like, you should put something about all the king's horses and all the king's men in that song. And I'm like, okay. So I do that, and of course, that becomes like the line in the song that everybody remembers. So then I have the song, and it's just another one of the songs that I wrote. And at that point, I was in Brooklyn Dreams, it really wasn't a kind of a Brooklyn Dreams kind of song. I mean, the songs that I wrote with Brooklyn Dreams were generally more R&B driven. Donna is supposed to go on the Johnny Carson show. And she comes to me, she says, I'm going to sing Starting Over tonight on the Johnny Carson show. And I'm like, babe, that's really sweet, but you can't do that. You have to go out and promote your new single. That's why you're going on the show. She's like, no, I think I'm going to do Starting Over Again. I'm like, but why? And she says, well, maybe if I sing it, your parents will stay together.
Wow.
Yes. Isn't that something?
Wow.
And I was like, well, you're amazing, whatever, and she did, and my parents didn't. So, but.
How did Dolly Parton get a hold of that? Because that was the number one country hit for her.
Literally the next day, we got a call from Dolly's people saying, what's that song? Has anybody recorded it? Can we do it? So. We said, yeah, please. Thank you.
Did Donna want to record it, or was it just, I'm just going to perform it and?
No, I don't know. I don't know if she would have recorded it or not. I mean, we did a demo of it with her singing, but again, my songs that aren't necessarily that suited to Donna's style. I mean, I co-wrote a lot of songs with Donna, but again, stylistically different than, but certainly a song like Starting Over Again, she could have done. I mean, there's a great version of her doing it with Eddie Rabbit. At some point, Eddie Rabbit was doing a TV special, and it was in Texas at, I forgot the name of the place, Billy Bob's or one of these big things. And they were filming the TV special there. And Donna did Starting Over Again there. And she just kills it, you know, I mean, but, you know, she kills anything. She has that voice.
And when you two met, you were in the band Brooklyn Dreams.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, again, more of an R&B disco type, like disco in like sort of the good sense of the word, not like the capital D, I don't know,
yeah,
style, well, category or whatever it was. I mean, I feel like that people now can look back on disco and that beat and think, wow, these records are really great. And, you know, what was the fuss about, you know, in terms of anyone having any problem with it? That's sort of how I look at it. But you guys were doing that and started working with her, and you were also signed to Casablanca, which was her label.
Yeah, well, originally we were signed to Jimmy Einer in New York, and the label was called Millennium. And Millennium was distributed by Casablanca. So our first album, which was, in my opinion, our best album, had, you know, let's say disco flourishes in that, you know, we use strings and horns on some of the records. And certainly our track, Music, Rhythm and Harmony, is a classic. And every DJ idolizes that song. Then when... we started working with Donna. Honestly, what I think happened was that Casablanca got nervous because we were basically together all the time. We were touring together. We went out and did a world tour as her opening act. And I just think that they wanted to make sure that they had Donna surrounded. And also for our second album, Casablanca bought out our contract for Millennium, and our second album was on Casablanca and was produced by Bob Esty, and was considerably more a disco record than the previous one.
Got it. Yeah. And then was Heaven Knows a song from you guys first, and then it became a Donna Summer collaboration, or?
Heaven Knows was a Donna record produced by Giorgio and Pete. And, you know, they asked Joe to sing the lead task, and we sang backgrounds. And then, because now we were on Casablanca, they thought it would be a good idea to reverse it. So Joe and Donna switched lead parts, and we put that version on the Brooklyn Dreams album.
Got it. And, yeah. And did you and Donna click first professionally or personally?
It basically happened simultaneously. We met, spent the first week together just hanging out, writing songs, getting to know each other, and that was it. You know, so it all happened at once.
What was it about her that wowed you the most?
I mean, who she was. You know, she's just an incredible person, and, you know, super talented, super human. You know, and I think, you know, her human qualities were the things that wowed me. Her compassion, her intuition, her generosity. Those were the things more than anything. You know, because when I met her, she had just had one song, Love to Love You, Baby, which in my mind at that particular time, like much of the world, was viewed as a novelty. So it wasn't that, you know, when we teamed up, I had this feeling of oh, here's this worldwide anything or this great artist in any way. It was just, I just met her. I barely knew anything about her. We just hit it off personally and creatively.
So what were the collaborations like when you guys would co-write a song?
It was very much how I still do it. It's stream of conscious. We would have, you know, basically an idea or not an idea or a thought or an idea to write something about, set up microphones, hit record on some kind of recorder and just jam. I mean, the way Bad Girls came about is that a second engineer at the studio was going through all these tapes, all these writing tapes that we had done from the night before to catalog them. And, you know, and basically told us, hey, there's this thing you did, Bad Girls, which is really cool. You should look at it. So we went back and revisited it and demoed it again. and the demo of it again, which is basically a Lynn drum machine, Joe being on acoustic guitar, me on electric guitar, and Donna and the Brooklyn Dreams just singing. And I put that as the end title track of the documentary.
This
version of Bad Girls that had never been heard. We just found it again recently. So
was Beep Beep Toot Toot already in it?
No.
So were you throwing in lyrics for that one or more music jam, or how did that work?
Yeah. I mean, often what I would do, especially on Bad Girls and the songs on that album is, I would take what we had, keep what was good, and then, you know, fill in the blanks for what needed, you know, if there was an ad lib or just a blah blah, or you know, something that it's kind of like being a doctor. I don't know what it is, but yeah. So
Zamboni machine.
Yeah.
You're smoothing out the rough spots on the ice or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you all were working on that album, did you think, oh, this album is a blockbuster?
I don't know that we thought, you know, I mean, in that particular period of time, you know, there was so much going on, you know, the energy, you know, it was a build of energy that was happening leading up to this record. So I don't know. I'm sure that we felt this is just going to be the continuation of this ride that's going 150 miles an hour. And you know, because you can feel the energy. You know, when things like that happen, you know, it's a communal effort. You know, there's a chemistry and a vibrancy and an energy that's happening on all levels. So, you know, you look at the artwork on the Bad Girls album. I mean, it's really awesome. You know, it folds out, the pictures on the inside. So, and my point is that everybody from the art department to the promotions department to Neil Bogart at the head of the company, to Giorgio and Pete and Harold Faltermeyer doing arrangements, and all of this energy and all of this talent just coming together and creating something, it just has its own momentum. You can't, you know, you can try and recreate these things but sometimes it just all comes together and all the pieces fit at the right moment and you come up with something that's super great.
So was that a happy time for you when that thing took off? Because, I mean, again, I remember, you know, being pretty young and a big radio listener then. And I mean, you heard Hot Stuff, Bad Girls a lot, you know, she was just on top of the world at that point.
Yeah.
What did that feel like for you guys?
I mean, it was super exciting. We were working a lot, you know, because at the same time this was happening, the Brooklyn Dreams album was out. And so we were on tour with Donna. We were doing our own, you know, we would do American Bandstand. Every city we went in, we would do radio and the local TV show. So it was just full on busy, you know. People always say to me, oh, you must have had a great time at Studio 54. What was Studio 54 like? And I'm like, I was working. I wasn't going to Studio 54. I was probably in Japan, you know. I mean, you know, I mean, obviously I went once or twice, but it wasn't like I was hanging out in discotheques at that time. We were, you know, it was interviews, touring, writing, recording, you know, nonstop. So, but it was a great time. We had fun.
Were the sort of raised, I don't know, kind of commercial expectations, you know, something that was hard for, you know, was that hard for her to live up to? Was that hard for you guys to sort of, you know, maneuver together? Was that a good thing?
I mean, maybe later on, not at that time. In that moment, it was all, everybody was on, you know, fine-tuned to the max. So I think after, you know, after you peak, You know, when you're peaking like that and you know, worldwide, it's after the peak that you start to figure out, like, okay, how do I maintain this? Where do I go? You know, and you know, the thing about Donna and Giorgio and the basically our whole crew was, it wasn't about repeating what you just did. It, you know, we were always wanting to go somewhere forward and somewhere else. And it wasn't so much worried about, you know, trying to make a hit bigger than the last one you had. It was more about on the creative side of how do you keep evolving your creativity? How do you keep refining it? What doors can you walk through that you haven't walked through before? What's happening in the zeitgeist that you could incorporate into the music in your own way? These were the challenges more than like, is it going to go to number one or is what, you know?
Yeah, it seemed like everything was happening very fast and that you had Bad Girls, I think, came out in the spring of 79. And then like that fall, they released the Greatest Hits record with On the Radio. I mean, that's pretty quick to like when you have this massive album that's riding to then put out the Greatest Hits. And then the next year you had out, she had out The Wanderer, which was a pretty adventurous, you know, follow-up too, which is exactly what you were just saying. I mean, she didn't try to remake Bad Girls. It had a little more of a rock edge to it. But that's like a lot in a year, year and a half.
Yeah, well, it speaks to what I'm saying about, you know, when you have a team of people who are super talented and caught up in that synergy of the moment, you know, you can put out a lot of stuff. It was a great team. There was a lot of talented people there. You know, Keith Forsey was the drummer. Keith went on to write Don't You Forget About Me, Flashdance, and was Billy Idol's producer. He was the drummer, you know. Then you had Harold Faltermeyer, who, you know, went on to do Beverly Hills Cop and Axel F. And then there's Giorgio and there's Pete and there's Joe Bean Esposito and there's me. And you know, the person that I always say goes underappreciated is the engineer, Jürgen Koppers. You know, you listen to that Bad Girls album, you see it jump out of the speakers. That right. was Jorgen. You know, Jorgen was a great engineer, you know. And then there's the team at Casablanca Records, you know, led by Neil Bogart, who was a brilliant, you know, visionary kind of guy who, you know, when he believed, you know, didn't take no for an answer and could find ways, you know, when people said no, he would find another way around, you know. So, you know, like when people said no to Love You, Baby, he put it on black stations, told the DJs to play it at midnight.
Did Donna like that pace of, you know, like, all right, let's go one thing, then the next, then the next?
Yeah. I mean, at some point you run out of gas and you're going to burn out and you don't want to do that. So you have to manage that. But you also have to, you know, as my father would say, strike while the iron's hot. You know, you know, you're in the moment. You've worked your whole life for this. This is what you dreamed about. And this is what it takes. Let's do it, you know.
So, and at some point in here, you started managing her, I think. And you're also artistically collaborating with her. And you guys got married. Like, how tricky was it to sort of manage all of those things at the same time?
I mean, it sounds tricky, but it really wasn't for us because... you know, I had my own career. I had my own things that I was doing in the beginning, you know, and then at some point I did a solo album, my first solo album, and I did it in 1980. And it was after that time that I realized that, you know, I couldn't manage trying to be the solo guy. Donna have her career, you know, she was now pregnant. Mimi was already here, you know, now Brooklyn is born. Right after that, Amanda's born. You know, I realized there was no way that I could navigate trying to keep my career as a solo artist, Donna's career, and our family together. So at that point, I said, I'm not going to be a solo artist anymore. I'm just going to be a songwriter. So I did. And I wrote for movies, and I wrote for this, and I wrote for that. You know, and I would go out on the road with Donna and sing background, play some guitar sometimes. Sometimes I would do a solo spot in her show. I would do a song or whatever. So, you know, we kept my toe in that side of it as well. And then at some point, there was a period of time where I did manage her. I don't know why, you know, it just became, you know, we basically had a team of people around us. And I don't even say a team because it's really only a few people. You know, we had my mother and our housekeeper, Rosa, who would take care of the kids when we were gone. You know, we have a great attorney and a great business manager, you know. And then, you know, at some point it became like, okay, if somebody, you know, I can book the tour with the and a great agent at William Morris. So between those few people, it was easy enough for me to just manage. You know, it wasn't like, you know, we needed Irving Azoff.
Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. As the weather heats up, Revolution's new premium lager, Cold Time, really hits the spot. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's never pasteurized, and the brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a slower, lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. Cold Time is available in 12 packs of 12-ounce cans. You know, music sort of kept evolving all this time. Would you guys get concerned about, like, well, how does she fit in, or how do I fit in with what's happening in music? Or is it just like, just do what we do and not worry about all that sort of thing?
I mean, you know, you continue to work with talented people and you follow your muse and you write the songs that you write. And you really can't chase stuff. You have to be yourself and you have to be your own artist. And we probably to the detriment of some way in both our careers, but certainly in Donna's career at the time, you know, there were things that we would say no to, you know, that in terms of career move might have been the right thing for a career, you know, but they weren't the right thing for us and our family. Our priorities weren't, you know, career first, everything else second. Our priority was family, life, healthy mind, body, and spirit, and also career. So in terms of you know, staying competitive in the sound or evolving in the sound, you know, I think Donna was always into that. And I basically said that earlier, and that, you know, she was always trying to move her envelope.
Right. What were the things you said no to?
Oh, I don't know. I don't remember any specific thing, but, you know, I just know that there were times that, you know, the agency or the record company or whoever might have been her management at the time would say, you should do this, you need to do this. And we would say no, you know. So, not in any obvious, bad way. It wasn't like a battle. But just to say that we were insular, you know, we were living our own lives and not subject to the whims so much of the business and all of that.
I mean, so she's been gone since May of 2012, which I imagine was like this kind of earth-shattering year for you. I think I'd read that your mother died that year also. So
yeah, my mother died 5 weeks before Donna.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy time.
At what point did you just sort of hole up for a while, or like how did you, you know, get through that?
I got through it by songwriting. You know, it was how I processed what was going on and then processed the loss. you know, it's the first record that I put out after that. It's called With Angels on a Carousel. That whole record more or less deals with all the emotions that I went through at that particular time. And, you know, I always say I've lived a charmed life, and that the only bad thing thus far in my life that I've ever experienced was losing my wife. You know,
which is a pretty big bad thing, but yeah.
But, you know, you have a choice in life, you know, and you know, I've always known what I was called to do. And when this happened, it became my refuge. And it became the challenge that I've always avoided taking, really, in that, you know, I was in Alive and Kickin', I was in Brooklyn Dreams. I stuck my toe into being a solo artist and then quickly took myself out of it. You know, because I've always had this subtle fear of having to sing solo on a stage and having all this attention focused on me. And I never really liked that. I preferred to be the songwriter and be surrounded by great singers. You know, Brooklyn Dreams, I had Joe Bean Esposito and Eddie Hogensen, two great singers. You know, I had Donna, a great singer. In Alive and Kickin', I had Pepe and Sandy, both great singers. So, you know, once Donna was gone, it seemed to be, you know, in that side of my psyche, the one challenge that I still needed to face. You know, since songwriting became my refuge and my way to process it, then putting out the record and then saying, okay, now I'm going to start to go out and play live. And it's been great. It's been a constant, you know, it's given me room to grow, you know, and to stay engaged as an artist, to, you know, walk through doors, to use an analogy I used earlier, that I haven't been in, walk into rooms that I haven't been in before, and maybe some rooms that I've been afraid to walk into before. So it's really been an invigoration for my life.
Was there sort of a back to basics element of this, in that what drove you to go back to writing wasn't like some career strategy? It was that you had to write, and you wanted to deal with the stuff in song, and you wanted to communicate through art. And that's like different from like a lot of hungry young artists who want to do that, but they also are looking at like, well, what do I do to make this popular?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, especially for me, because, you know, the true like Bruce Sudano song is a song like Starting Over Again, you know, where it's an emotional story and it's a real life story. These are the kind of songs that, you know, are my strength. Understanding what you're saying about artists, you know, that this was a good part of when I was writing in the 80s, where, I'm trying to write songs that are, you know, right for the marketplace. That wasn't necessarily songs like Starting Over Again, you know, coincidentally.
Right. And that was a big hit.
Yeah. And even a song like Bad Girls, you know, it's a social song. The lyric of that song is a social commentary. It's not, you know, I love you or, you know, not that, you know, I also can write a love song, but, where I wrote love songs is when I fell in love again a number of years ago and remarried and experienced a feeling of love in a new way at a new time in my life. So, you know, that's Spirals Volume 2, you know, that whole record is, you know, Morning Kisses, Keep Doing What You're Doing, you know, The Promise. These were all songs of, you know, a guy of my age falling in love.
Right. I was listening to the new album, and you have a song, Two Bleeding Hearts, that you did with Valerie Simpson, who's really great to hear again. And not that this is what the song's about, but, you know, you're singing two bleeding hearts and a wounded love. And you know, she lost, you know, Nicholas Ashford in 2011. And, you know, I was thinking, you know, in a way you guys have that sort of broken heart element in common as well. And I just don't know whether there was any extra emotional charge in doing that song with her.
Yeah, it's kind of the unspoken truth of that. You know, she and I, you know, we spoke about Nick and Donna, but we didn't speak about them in relation to this song. But it was there, you know, because as you picked up on, you can interpret that somehow in that mix, you know. But this just happened, you know. I wrote the song and I just felt like it should be a duet. I mean, I'm not close with Valerie. I've met her over the years and I've crossed paths with her, but it was literally, I wrote this song, thought it needed to be a duet. I'm talking to Cindy, my manager, and you know, she was like, well, who do you think it should be? And, you know, I Valerie just came out of my mouth. I don't even know why, you know, it's not even an obvious choice, really, I don't think. But it was a pleasure and it worked out really well. I love how the record came out. I love the simplicity of it. I love it's just me on acoustic guitar and her on piano and a little bass and drum and our vocals. Really special. She's so sweet and it was such an honor for me to have her on my record. You know, I mean, she's an icon in my mind of songwriting. So,
Absolutely. No, it was like, I was like, oh, it's like being visited from an old friend you never actually knew, but it's like, well, I never knew her, but it was like, oh, that's cool. When you put out a new album in 2024, like, what is the sort of expectation for it, or what is the hope for it? I mean, it's a very different world than, you know, it was, and people consume music differently. Although people, you know, my age, your age, you know, we're still sort of albums people. But when you go into it, sort of what is your hope when you put it out into the world?
My expectations are, I would say, open. I don't have any expectations. My expectations are at this point are I'm just trying to create the best art I can make. You know, I look at it in just in terms of my life and my career, you know, and I don't know where it leads. I don't know what it means. You know, I don't know what song affects what person at what place in time. I don't know any of that. I, you know, my commitment is just to do what I do, what I believe I was called to do, that I'm still inspired to do, you know, and navigate what happens in on the outside world as best as I can. But, you know, it's I don't view it like with any expectation of, you know, what can you expect? You know, I mean, radio is, you know, basically meaningless. And so, you know, you just live your life, carry on your career, stay creative, play some live shows, enjoy your grandkids, see if you can write another great song and then you just, it's all in God's hands. You know what I mean?
do you try to write like every day, or do you write more when you sort of have a project in mind?
I try to write. I wouldn't say I try to write every day, but, you know, I live my life between LA and Milan, you know, these days, Milan is really fertile soil for me in terms of songwriting. All of this record I wrote in Milan. It's because, you know, I have a lot of space in Milan. I don't have a lot of friends. All my friends are in America. The time zone is completely, you know, upside down. So I have a lot of space to ruminate, to play, to think, to go on long walks, to read books, and without, you know, the business of LA all of that and grandkids, you know, I'm in a completely different world. So it allows me to have to view it all from a different perspective and a more wide open perspective. So it's been working for me.
That's great. Well, good luck with, you know, this coming out and, you know, people hearing it, obviously. And, you know, I hope there are opportunities to see you perform it live. You should probably come over to Chicago because, you know, pretty big city. We appreciate good singer-songwriters. So
thanks, Mark. Appreciate it.
That's all for episode 128 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Bruce Sudano for sharing so much about his life and music with Donna Summer and his own adventures from the 1960s through today. Talking Ugly Truth, Telling Pretty Lies is out digitally now and will be released on April 26th on vinyl and CD. He has two Florida live shows scheduled for April 11th at the Culture Room in Fort Lauderdale and April 12th at the Billheimer Capital Theater in Clearwater. Go to brucesudano.com for more information about his music and upcoming live dates. You also can follow Bruce Sudano on Instagram and Twitter. Karopop is produced by Chris Swake, who is too good to be true. Now you can become a Karopop friend for a mere $24. Please contribute at karopop.com. Your support is much appreciated. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Karopop on Twitter, X, and Instagram at Karopopcast. And you can follow me as well at Mark Caro at M-A-R-K-C-A-R-O. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Karopop conversation. Thanks.